Hawaii, and you're 96 years old and one of the original members of the Outrigger Canoe Club. Could you tell me a little bit about what the beach was like? And first of all, though, tell me, how did you happen to come to Hawaii?
Well, my father was with the Immigration Service in Los Angeles, and he didn't see any prospects there. So my mother had some friends who grew up with her in Allerton, Iowa, who had moved to Hawaii. She wrote to one of his friends, Mrs. May Hubbard, and asked if they knew of any position open that my father could hold in Honolulu.
Yes.
So they wrote back and said they had an opening at the Hawaiian Sugar Bladders Experiment Station, which at that time was located on Wilder and Kiyomoko Street in Honolulu. And my father said he'd be glad to take the job of bookkeeper. So we then went to Hawaii under those circumstances.
What age were you?
Well, let's see.
About 9 years old?
About nine and a half. Graduated in 1914 from Punahou School at age 16. So how old would I be?
I think you were nine.
I entered the fifth grade and I skipped the sixth grade.
Yes, you and your brother were in the same class. He was a year and a half older than you.
I skipped grade so I could join him in the same class because the teacher said you could run off to college together and you probably want to go at the same time.
I think it was because you were so bright, too.
No. At any rate, I was able to skip grade.
Well, you were bright enough to become president of your class.
Well, that's later on. That's
in the high school.
In the high school. Which we then called Oahu College.
That's right. Now, to go back to your the first summer you spent at the beach, what did Waikiki Beach look like at that time?
Well, it was wide open. As I remember, there was a seaside hotel for the
Royal Hawaiian.
The Royal Hawaiian is now at the Moana Hotel next to it. The Alfred and Canoe Club later was founded in between the two.
I see.
And the Hawaiian boys, maybe about five or six of them, took tourists out of the canoes to surf in the Outrigger canoes. And at that time, there were a few of these Hawaiian boys that were still surfing. What they call canoe surf, the queen surf.
Yes.
Which is out opposite the Queen's former home. The beaches of those two hotels were the only ones there instead of like downtown New York, isn't it?
That's true. Who were some of those Hawaiian boys?
Duke Anamoko, I know, was one of them. And I can't remember.
Yes, I think some of his brothers and some of the others. And you and your brother used to have surfboards?
Yeah, after we'd been here about a year, there was a British journalist named Alexander Hugh Ford who went around the world as a public relations expert for the different parts of the world. And he got to Hawaii and he bought the be a nice thing to revive the art of surfboard riding, which was pretty dead by that time. So he got together with a number of them. Local businessmen who were willing to assist him in forming what they call the Outrigger Canoe Club. That was in about
1908 it was.
1908, yeah.
Now, what was Pop Ford like? What did he look like?
Well, what did he look like? He looked like an English character. I'm not formal. What you'd expect of a public relations
informal. Mm-hmm. And when he encouraged you to form a canoe club, how many youngsters were there?
right at the beginning, I would say there were only about 20 of us all together.
Do you remember the names of any of the others?
No, I can't remember the names of any of the boys that were then there. I know one older person we called Dad Severin.
Yes. How much older was he?
Well, to us, he seemed like an older our father, but he was probably 18 or 19 years old.
Yes. Was he a good surfer?
About Duke's age. Yeah, he was a good surfer. Of course, we all started what we called little surfers. Mm-hmm. At that time, we just outside the seaside hotel. And then we graduated there to canoe surfers out of the Moana Hotel. Mm-hmm. That got pretty real when we went on or got the Queen Surfer, which was obviously Queen Anne's former home.
Judge Tuttle, where did you get your board?
Well, they had it for sale at the beach, I guess. I'm sure.
Were they big?
Well, these are redwood boards. They had no fin, as they do now. They were elongated and then spread out to about 18 inches. And then the caves were near void at the top. And they were about 7 or 8 feet tall.
That's a pretty big board for a little boy.
Well, it seems so heavy. My back, yeah.
Would you carry them down from your home?
Oh, no, we left them at the Outrigger Club.
I see, after the Outrigger Club started. What kind of a clubhouse was it? Do you remember?
Well, there was a little grass shack at the main office. There was a pavilion built out on the lagoon, which and it between the steep side.
Put down the camp from there, please.
And it was just then really a grass shack, mostly.
Well, look, then there was a locker room and a dressing room, which was wooden structure.
And it was just for boys?
Just for boys.
Yes, about 20 of you started it.
That's right.
And did your fathers then raise money to start the club?
I guess he did. I wasn't familiar with that. We just took advantage of it.
What happened to Pop Ford?
About 2 years in Honolulu, he decided to move on someplace else. I don't know where he went, but that's Whitey.
We had a little interruption there while they opened the door. So we'll go on and continue now. Pop Ford disappeared, and because he was a wanderer. And what happened to the club? Who took over?
Well, by that time, they had a pretty good organization, and I forgot who the first president was, but my father was elected the second president of the club. Incidentally, I want you to tell me the name of the president of the club.
His name's Charles Swanson, Captain Charles Swanson. We call him Chuck Swanson. He's the one you had dinner with the other night.
Mm-hmm. Charles Swanson.
S-W-A-N-S-O-N, Swanson.
Before you leave, I want you to give us a couple of his address.
I shall. Mm-hmm. And so then your father took over as sort of an interim president?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first...
I think Pop Ford was the first president.
Yeah, the first time he was president. He took Ford's place for a year, and then he was elected president. Second term.
Mm-hmm. He was elected, I believe, as the fourth president.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To go back to the beach, though, at that time, was the surf high? Was it up? Was it a big surf?
Well, just like it is now, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did it take you long to learn to surf?
No, it's very easy in the small surf. You just pull the board and jump on it and come in. Mm-hmm. Once you learn how to do that, then you could go out, paddle out, catch a wave, and canoe surf.
Did Duke Hanamoku show you how to do this?
No, he was just spending his time making money carrying tourists out.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You know, later on he wanted to swim in the Olympics, and at that time the Olympics...
We have a nice picture of him, though.
Was run by the American Athletic Union, and he had to get a special permit to swim because he was a professional at that time. But they gave him a special permit because there had been no amateur sports in Hawaii at that time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And was he a remarkable swimmer? When you were on the beach, you noticed that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody can tell that he was a remarkable swimmer.
And he did go on to the Olympics, and he won them, which is...
The Olympic 100-yard race.
Yes.
They ran it in yards and instead of meters.
Mm-hmm.
He knocked 6 seconds off the 100-yard swimming record.
Were there many tourists on the beach?
Oh, yeah. Good many tourists. Nothing as close like there are now. But I remember the beach was pretty well filled on Saturday.
Yes, and who did teach you to surf?
Nobody.
No, you did.
Mm-hmm. We just followed all other people did.
Mm-hmm. And did you get very proficient? You went all the way up to Queens.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we were proficient.
Would you say that you were the first Howleys to surf? The first?
Oh, no.
No, no. Mm-hmm. There were others.
Not so far as I know. Bad Center, for instance, was a
Howley. Yes. Mm-hmm. But you were the first little boys, really, to be in the Outrigger Canoe Club, weren't you?
Well, I think maybe Forrest and Campbell were in the club at the same time we were. He was a classmate of ours at Foot Over.
I see. What was his name again?
Marston Campbell.
Marston Campbell.
He moved to the West Coast after he graduated from Foot Over. He has no relatives now at Hawaii.
Well, Judge Tettle, we're going to move up Mauka now and go up to around Punahou, and I want you to tell me a little bit about your years in the school, because you became quite famous, you and your brother, for building the first flying apparatus. I believe it was a glider. Could you tell me a little about that?
Yes, when we graduated from Punahou Academy, which was the grade school, I was then, 12 years old. Malcolm was 13, and we built a model airplane, which was an exact copy of the Wright Brothers' plane. The Wright Brothers had just flown the first time in heavy air machines in 1903. There was a lot of publicity about it, and so at that time we thought it would be interesting for the class graduation period for us to build a model airplane. We put a little electric motor in it, and the propellers, and the battery in it, and it ran the propellers in it, and it made quite a hit.
Of course, it wasn't that little. It was about a wingspan of about 4 feet, wasn't it?
About 4 feet.
Yes, it wasn't a little toy. You know, it's a good size model.
But of course, it wasn't supposed to fly.
Hmm.
And then after that summer, well, first of all, we got a good deal of publicity in the Advertiser about that event. That summer, we built a glider, which was about 18 feet across, and the biplane, two wings, one over the other, and then a tail piece behind it, and you're supposed to run down the hill and hand glide. And so we did that, and Malcolm ran down the hill to hand glide, and bit of wind caught on the left side of the thing and flipped it over on the side and broke it.
Oh dear.
And so I never got a chance to
fly. I really don't. I believe you were living up in Kaimuki at that time, weren't you?
We lived in Kaimuki at 6th Avenue and Kaimuki, yes.
And so you actually went up those hills there at Kaimuki and...
Went up on the hill behind he ran down the hill to glide.
I believe your brother was actually able to go about 40 feet, wasn't he?
That's right, he did.
So, in effect, you brothers were the first to be airborne in Hawaii.
That's right, and heavier than air machines.
And the heavier than air machine, which you built yourself.
At the age of 13.
At the age of 13, isn't that extraordinary?
And that's that Christmas at the Central Union Church. The Christmas party in the Sunday school. They built a cable down from the gallery down to the dais in front. Malcolm flew the glider down that cable and Santa Claus.
Did he really? Yeah. Extraordinary.
He got a lot of publicity in the advertising.
I'm sure he did. You said, speaking of your Punahou days, that they were influential in your feeling of racial equality, and which later in your life became a very important force. And was it because there were so many classmates that were all different races?
No doubt about that, yes, because in my classes there were full-blooded Hawaiians, there were former Hawaiians, there were Papa Hawaiians, and they were all different. And there were Japanese and Chinese. We had a couple of Chinese students. We had three Chinese students. I remember one of them was the valedictorian in our class. He was about 6 or 7 years old, and the rest of them.
I see. What was his name?
I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah, remember. Well, I'm sure that could be.
But the other two were John and Alfred Yap. And the Japanese student, Sakamoto, he later came to the came to the mainland, or the States, we used to say.
Yes.
And became a professional baseball player.
That's interesting. Goodness.
And, of course, we had Portuguese, and we had people from Puerto Rico and from the Philippines. So I got to know people of all races and creeds and colors.
Right. And that. I'm going to take you back to the mainland now. How did you happen to go back? You went back, your father was transferred?
No, we went back to the mainland because the professor of Cornell in the German class recommended that we go to Cornell University because Malcolm was going to study engineering, and he could study engineering as an undergraduate there, and I could study to become ready to go to Harvard Law School in the same school. And, so we decided to go to Cornell for that reason.
I see.
Then, well, Cornell, I had a classmate, a fraternity brother of mine, who invited me home for summer vacation. 1917, and I went south on a ship with him to Jacksonville, Florida, where he lived with his family. And as I said the other day, we got off the ship at 10 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock. I met this friend, the little girl next door. And a year later, we were engaged and married.
You remember that? Was it love at first sight, Mrs. Tuttle?
It was.
It was. You and
I think for both of us. We've been having bad.
That's Sarah Tuttle. And there's a story about your sitting on the porch with your mother and seeing a bus go by. And could you tell me that story?
That was before you came to the islands, was it not?
That was before we came to the island.
I see.
My father at that time was a clerk in the, what was called the War Department then. It's later become the Department of the Army. And so we were in Washington. And one afternoon, I was sitting on the front porch with my mother. And we were right at the corner of the street when the streetcar stopped. A streetcar came by, and there was a black woman standing on the corner. The streetcar passed her by and stopped. And she stood waiting. Another car came by and passed her by and it stopped. So she got up and went to the house and put on her hat and went down and stood at the street corner.
Your father did?
Yeah. And stood next to the lady, and then the streetcar came by, and of course it stopped for her. And she said to the black woman, she said, "You go ahead." So she turned around.
And the black woman got her ride. And that's a wonderful story. Later on in your career, you were very responsible for the integration of some of the universities in, yeah, in the South. Could you tell me a little about that? Because it really is, you did become a judge then.
Well, in, when I went south, I've been interested in politics, in government, I mean, not in politics particularly, but I couldn't belong to the Democratic Party because it was then known as the White Democratic Party and no black person was allowed to vote, not even allowed to register to vote. So I helped organize the fledgling Republican Party. And the long time for the election for 1932. General Eisenhower running
for the president. Well, that's 1952, Dad.
1952, thank you. When General Eisenhower was running for the presidency, I organized a group of Republicans from Georgia to support Eisenhower. And we went to the convention, and there was a opposing delegation for Senator Taft, and it ended quite a fight. But Eisenhower was finally nominated. And shortly after he was nominated, he appointed me general counsel of the Treasury Department, which took Sarah and me to Washington. And 2 years later, I got a call from a friend of mine in New Orleans named John Wisdom, who asked me if I'd be interested in filling the new judgeship. Seventh judgeship had just been created from the Fifth Circuit. I told him I wasn't able to because I promised the secretary that I would stay with him 2 years. I said, John, I said, however, before he appoints somebody else, I'd be appreciated for giving another call. So about 2 months later, Bill Rogers, who was the deputy attorney general, called me on the phone and said, "You'd do us a great favor if you were to take that job on the Fifth Circuit. But the man that Texas wants, we don't consider it to be worth filling a job as dog catcher, let alone the judgeship. They have a lot of demand on us because they have more cases going to the Fifth Circuit in Texas than at the other state. But if knowing how much you have done for the party, if it accommodated you, why, if they wouldn't oppose it." I said, "I have found a nice way to do a man a favor to take that kind of a job." So I took the job on the Fifth Circuit.
And during that tenure on this, it was during the 60s, you says that you ordered the integration of a set of state universities in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi.
Right.
As judge. So you really did a great deal for integration, didn't you?
No, it's going again.
Is it all right?
You asked if I knew Mark.
Yes, I did.
I was elected to the Court of Trustees of Morehouse College, Spelman College, and the Band University, which are all historically black colleges. And on the board of each of those, Martin Luther King Sr. was a member, the same time I was. Actually, after I was appointed to the bench, I, of course, knew a lot about Martin Luther King, but I never actually met him. We attended the dinner given in his honor the year he received the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes.
So I met him and spoke to him, but actually on the court I wrote many opinions which supported the action he was taking.
Yes, I'd like to just for a minute say that Jimmy Carter said that you were a beacon of light of judicial temperament, of personal courage, and of commitment to the finest elements of justice in this country at a time when it was not easy to do. President Carter said, he's always been a hero of mine. That's you, Judge Tuttle. And another lawyer, an NAACP lawyer, Constance Baker Motley, said this of you, he brought the Deep South kicking and screaming into the 20th century. I think that's a wonderful quote, and I think what you did must have been very courageous. Were you at any time threatened or intimidated? Or?
Not on account of those actions.
Not on account of those actions.
Some of the judges that participated principally in desegregating for the Fifth Circuit were called by a dissenting judge before. They consisted of John Wisdom, who's the man that got me on the court, and later came on the court, fortunately, and John Brown of Houston, and Judge Richard Reeves of Montgomery. Richard Reeves was a Southerner, so he had a much harder time with his friends for the action he took, and many of the rest of us, also in a smaller town of Montgomery. He was insulted at the food, and people in his own church wouldn't sit on the same seat with him. And he had painted his son the grave with red paint and that sort of thing.
He was arguing with the I think he suffered the most.
Yes, he suffered the most. Both of any of us. I was fortunate in that. In Atlanta, the editor of the Constitution, Ralph McGill, was a very liberal editor, and he supported our action. And so did the Catholic Archbishop, I think his name was... I can't recall his name.
I'm sure he will later.
But the rabbi of the Jewish temple there was very helpful.
I believe that, was it your father was a friend of the father of the current mayor of Atlanta, is that true? Or,
no.
I read somewhere about the present mayor of Atlanta making some connection with you. He's black, and
no.
I don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to skip another couple of generations, and bring you up to the time when you were 87, and I heard you had a triple bypass operation. Is that right, at the age of 87?
This is so unimportant, I've forgotten.
Well, what's important is the fact that you had it in September, and by Thanksgiving you were out playing golf again.
That's right.
I think that's pretty sensational.
I think, to be correct, he was 89. They asked me, his son, said, and I'm a doctor, they said, you know, this is a big operation, and he's 89 years old. I said, oh, he's not really 89. But I think that was his chronological age. But he did get back to playing golf.
Well, I see you now, and you look great, and you certainly have total recall, which is remarkable. And your wife's as lovely as ever.
Thank you.
You really are. I'm going to take you back now again a little bit to Punahou. What were some of the other memories there that you can recall? To ask you just cold like that's a little difficult. But were there any events that took place at that time other than the flying one that that you would like to talk about?
Well, during the years at the Yamaha College, I played the King and Love's Labor Lost. I was a member of the Glee Club, as I recall it, and I was the business manager of the Owakwan by last year.
Mm-hmm. You were in other sports, too, weren't you? Mm-hmm.
Yes, I tried to play football. I was on what they call the third team, and one scrimmage one afternoon, I tried to tackle Bill Inman, who weighed about 200 pounds, and I woke up the next morning It's not quite true, but almost.
Almost true.
Those days, we didn't even have helmets.
It's amazing.
And then I took up cross-country running, which was not quite as...
dangerous.
Quite as dangerous, right.
Who was the headmaster at that time?
Arthur Griffiths.
And about how many students were there in the academy and also in Wahoo College?
In Wahoo College, in my class, there were 38 students. Let's see, four times that would be 200 students in Wahoo College.
There were boarding students, too?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And with the academy, I guess there are about 600 or 700 on the academy.
I see. And at that time, too, where were you living? Where was your home?
To start out with, it lived on the corner of Jim Opo and the cross street, I think, is B Howell, I'm not sure. And then later we moved out to Kaimakee.
Yes, I believe your mother bought some property out there and you built a house.
That's right.
Yes. Were there many houses there?
Not many. There were, I think, only four on the six